Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme devoted to climate change. Last week we heard from Dr. Alice Bowes of the Tyndall Centre, who co-authored a report for Friends of the Earth and Cooperative Bank, which includes the following statement. It is important to recognise that according to current scientific understanding, to have a very high probability of not exceeding 2 degrees C would require a complete cessation of carbon emissions from today. This week we meet one London resident who is well on his way to reducing his carbon footprint to zero. Donoghue McCarthy lives in an ordinary terraced house in South London and has a carbon footprint of just half a ton. That's about 1/16th of the carbon emissions of the average European household. Over the next half hour, Donoghue takes us on a guided tour around his house, and we begin outside the front by taking a look at his domestic wind turbine. So, when did you buy this? How much does it cost and how much is it producing in terms of energy?
My wind turbine, it got installed in 2005, November.
And what model is it?
It's an Eclectic Energy D400. It cost £3,000 to have it installed. It was the first wind turbine in London to get planning permission for a grid-connected microturbine. I got planning permission in 2003 because it was very hard to find a product that actually was doing what we needed to do. To be perfectly frank with you, this is still an experimental model. It's producing less than maybe 100 watt a day, which is very low. Produces enough to supply my electric lighting, but I've got very low load on electric lights. It's basically, I think that's the question, what's the space as they develop more and better inverters. The turbine, as you can hear, is perfectly silent, so that's quite exciting. Good weight for a domestic house. The real challenge is converting the energy efficiently from AC from DC to AC, and that's only a developing technology.
Okay.
Obviously, on the roof as well, there's just behind here there's the rain harvester. That'll cost me around £200 or £300 to put in. It saves me around £100 a year, so that's quite a good investment.
Oh, you're completely off grid in terms of water?
Around 80 to 90% of my WC needs are provided by the rain harvester on the roof.
Right.
And a reasonable amount of my other
water. So you've got a water meter, which you just pay as you go. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. I got the water meter put in last November because I thought I could actually make some money.
And you have been?
I have been, yeah. I'm having equivalent of maybe... last time I looked at it, I was saving around £130-140 a year.
Wow.
And that meant that it was paying for itself around 3 years, but also meant I was equivalent of maybe having a very nice dinner out on Thames water every year. Do you want to talk about under the roof?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, it's going up to 200 watts today.
All right, it's quite fairly windy out.
Yeah.
That's about as high as it gets.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, as you heard me just saying, it's a very modest output from these wind turbines at the moment. The issue is that basically nobody's actually designed inverters specifically. Because the profile of the wind, it goes up and down all the time.
Right.
It's actually the profile of energy coming out of a solar panel or other type of instrument would be much more constant. So it really is a challenge for technology to handle this. I'm convinced they'll do it, but it just needs money has to be invested and time invested into making these things work properly. What you're looking at there, it's called a windy buoy, but it's just really basically an adapted inverter for a solar electric system. And so not working, as far as I'm concerned, as good as it can get. But hey, I'm part of the experiment, and we're moving forward.
Okay. And
here you have actually the two meters, 1 meter like you have at home, which measures how much I'm selling to the national grid.
Yep.
And 1 meter here, just exactly like you have at home, except it's going in reverse. It means that it's measuring how much electricity is going out of the house. And what happens is I take a reading on the 6th of February every year, and I send London Electricity a bill, and they pay me. Usually it takes them a little bit of time. I haven't had to send them a red letter yet, but working now.
Right, great. So we're in the bathroom?
In the bathroom, which is where you can see the piping directly down from the rain harvester on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tap here, which if you have a look, That's pure London rainwater. As you can hear, as I'm putting and as I pour down the sink, you can see how clean it is.
Yeah, it looks absolutely clean.
Obviously, everything in the kitchen is low energy fridge, low energy washing machine, low energy light bulbs. Here's a display for the solar electric solar hot water system, and it's a really grey day in October, so it's not brilliant today. The roof at the moment is 23 degrees,
and the light's going. It's kind of isn't it? It's near towards the end of the day.
So the roof at the moment is 23 degrees, mm-hmm. which means that it isn't, and the bottom of the tank is 24 degrees, so it doesn't actually, so it's not working.
Right.
It's switched off. But the top of the tank is 26 degrees. So if I want to shower tonight, let's say I'd have to turn on the backup system to bring it up to 39 degrees. That's probably the first or second day since last April I would have had to turn it on. So, and I'm hoping once I've had the wood burning stove, then I'll be able to boil water on that, and that'll help find a sustainable way of heating water in the winter. So I'll have the two will balance out each other. Yeah. I mean, that's actually a feature of what I believe the whole solution to global warming will be. It's like a jigsaw. You put them all together. There's no one solution. You know, nuclear isn't the answer, or wind turbines are the answer. It's actually, you know, a little bit of wind turbines, a little bit of solar, a little bit of electric, a little bit of wood, a little bit of conservation. You put it all together, you're there. That's the tank for the hot water system. Basically, there's a panel on the roof that has
it's quite small, isn't it? For listeners, how many gallons is?
Oh, I wouldn't have a clue.
Okay.
I'm useless. It's an ordinary hot water tank.
Okay, so you get about a shower's worth.
No, that's not the tank. This is the tank behind here.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
That's the tank for the antifreeze. Basically, what happens is there's a very narrow pipe that goes in through a glass panel on the roof, and that goes around in a circle and goes into the hot water tank. So the water from the tank never goes on the roof. It's only the antifreeze.
Yep,
this little tank here stores the antifreeze. That goes around in a circle. This is the electric motor there, and that's powered by a solar electric panel on the wall, which charges up a battery, and that powers that. Mm-hmm. So anytime the roof is hot, the antifreeze goes around in a circle and picks up the heat and heats up my hot water. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's fantastic. In summer, it has to limit. It can't go. It limits it. It could go up above 100. There's a safety system that stops it going above 70 degrees. But one day, actually, if it switched off the system by mistake, and I found actually the antifreeze had gone up to 105 degrees, which is incredible. I mean, the amount of heat that we're wasting on our roofs is enormous. Mm. But I could probably provide a shower for everybody in the street during the summer.
Mm.
But I obviously don't. I think I'm strange.
Remind us of the ballpark kind of figure for installing one of these nowadays.
They're around three to 5,000.
Okay.
Depending on the size and the conditions of your roof and whether they've got to have scaffolding or not. That's one of the big costs.
Okay.
They say there's a payback period of between 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Also depends on how many people are using it and how effective you're using it.
There's a number of companies doing it now?
Oh, there's quite a few companies. That's probably the more mature markets. Because there was a flurry in the late 70s, in the early 70s, after the first major oil crisis, the OPEC oil crisis. There's something like 70,000 systems in the country. Interestingly enough, where do you think what country in the world has the most solar hot water systems?
Germany?
No. China.
China?
China's got the largest number of installed. They've got something like 75% of the world's installed hot water systems.
Is that recent?
Yeah.
Recent build?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And the other thing, of course, I mean, Brazil is the country with the largest amount of biofuels, something like 67% of their motor fuels is biofuel, which actually shows, you know, we talk about the developed world and the developing world, but actually, hang on, let's look at some of the figures and we actually get it paints a different story.
Yeah.
Come out into the garden, you'll actually have a chance to look at the back roof of the house. As you can see, it's just an ordinary 1840s to up to down cottage. It used to be market gardeners living around here, and you can see the wind turbine flying around, no noise. Next level down is the solar electric panels. They provide electricity for the house. Next panel down is the panel that provides electricity to power the motor for the hot water system. And next level down, you've got the hot water panels, and then you've got my rain barrel.
Okay. So this just access for the
garden. Yeah. I mean, the rain harvester provides the water for the WC and washing, but this just provides it for the garden.
PV, did you give us a price on that?
The PV cost me £13,000.
Ten panels.
Yeah, it's a 1.2 kilowatt system, which is fairly modest in today's terms. Most systems now being put in around 2 kilowatt.
Yeah.
It was put in 1999, cost me £13,000, but I had to pay 17.5% VAT in those days. So they used to use drag me around the House of Parliament as a victim, saying I had to pay £2,000 to help you achieve your CO2 target in tax. I've actually paid far more in tax than I've actually ever gotten grants for my systems in the house. That's the system nowadays. With today's grants, you could probably get for around £7,000. It's around £3,500, including grants now, per kilowatt installed. So to put in 2 kilowatts, you're getting to almost £7,000, which, you know, compared to... It's actually becoming more affordable for a lot of people. It's not even the price of a medium-range car now. Solar water system, I said, was around between £3,000 and £5,000. Wind turbine, £3,000. Rain barrel, 30 quid.
And what's the take-up of these things in London and the rest of the UK?
It's tiny. There's a reasonable number of hot water systems in, around 70,000. The take-up of PV is tiny still, less than 100 in London since I put mine in 99. Wind turbines, I think there's one or two in London. The rain harvest systems, I haven't heard of anybody else. I mean, there are companies who install them, but I've never met anybody who has one.
All right.
But they, you know, there are companies who install big professional ones now. And wood burners, which is my next project, as you can see here, I've got a whole load of timbers I've been breaking up and at the end of the garden. And also been making my logs out of my newspapers. Actually, it's quite fun. So that's going to be installed in November. And I'm quite excited about it. It's actually, unlike the other technologies, it does require some labour. So it's not really compatible with a modern London lifestyle. Mm. But with the crisis that we're facing, I feel I've got the initiative or the inspiration to actually feel I've got to reduce my CO2 as fast as possible. We've got a window of 5 to 10 years to really take the crisis seriously. And I think wood burners have a role to play. It's a real shame the government don't provide grants for them. Again.
Okay. Great. All right, thanks. Oh, yeah, you got compost.
I think it's around August I started researching having wood for a wood burner.
Oh, okay.
And look how much timber I've just got. You're just literally going for walks around the streets.
Mm. Actually quite a... kind of a third of a skip full or something.
Yeah, and that's only one thing, and there's all this as well. There's more. Hmm. Oh, look at this.
Wow, so
look at that. That's
a huge chunk here.
That's timber. That's just been dumped. And this is not me going and spending hours walking around trying to find timber. This is literally going for a bar of chocolate.
Right, coming back
with one or two bits each time I go back. That's my compost heap. Not a very elegant one, but it was built with recycled, recovered bricks on the green currency scheme that we had in Southwark.
Okay.
So we didn't have to pay any cash for it.
Great. That saves methane in landfill.
Exactly.
So that's helping with the...
CO2 emissions in the car, sorry.
Yeah.
But also, it cuts down the waste of petrol on carrying it and transport.
As well as having a tiny carbon footprint and relying on rainwater for much of his water needs, Donoghue calculates that during 1 year, he accumulates just one half of one wheelie bin of non-recyclable rubbish.
I produce half a wheelie bin of rubbish, non-recycled rubbish, a year.
A year?
A year, yeah. I measured it 1 year. Mm. The year before last, I measured it over the
year. So that's just being vigilant about what you buy and reducing, looking for stuff that doesn't have packaging.
Exactly.
Or refusing the stuff that has packaging.
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky, there's a shop, an organic cooperative nearby where I can get bags and fill up for muesli, so there's no boxes or bags involved. And my fruit and veg come with a local box game that's delivered by bicycle, and they deliver in bags and you give them back the bags. So my honey jars, there's a local community, there's a community garden that has a hives. So when I'm finished with my honey jars, they go to them. So add it all up and you end up with only half a wheelie bin a year.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah,
it is possible.
Yeah, that's great.
In 1992, Donoghue was at the peak of his career as a ballet dancer playing lead roles at the Royal Opera House. But that year he was invited to take part in a trip to the Amazon rainforest in Venezuela. He ended up spending 2 weeks alone with the indigenous Yanomami people, which, as he explains, proved pivotal.
I got involved in this literally way back in 1992. Up to then I had very little interest or knowledge of really what was going on in the wider environmental crisis. and ended up on this trip to the Yanomami, and I ended up by being by myself with the Yanomami Indians, and they were very good to me, an amazing experience. But I did see it firsthand, the beginning of the destruction of the forest, even around where they lived, and I felt emotionally they had no concept of ownership. And you just trying to explain to them that they had no hope unless they had ownership of their land, it was meaningless to them. And I came back to Britain quite gutted that there were 6 million indigenous people in the Amazon region when Western civilization arrived. There's now less than 600,000, and it's still being eliminated. The genocide goes on. And I felt so emotional about it. I couldn't deal with rainforest issues because I felt they were a symptom. I felt you could devote your life to protecting the rainforest, and all you'd be doing is pushing the stone up a hill. What was really causing destruction was our Western destructive lifestyles. And I felt that had to be dealt with rather than of root causes, rather than actually dealing with a symptom. And so I decided to do what I could as an ordinary human being to stop Britain destroying the planet, and came back and thought the most important thing you could do is actually put your own house in order. And so I started the process of trying to make my life sustainable, and it goes on to this day. It's a slow process, but and I really had, in those days, you really had to look at, you know, I was always looking for different places to try and find practical things rather than just, you know, talk or articles that didn't have any substance. I wanted to know, can you give me something or an action or an absolute concrete path by which I can actually reduce my impact? And so I spent the years researching that and trying to implement my house and gradually realising my dream as the years go by. But also got involved in politics, defending a local park from Middleton, and through that got involved and became a local councillor, and then became elected to the board of the Liberal Democrats nationally, and then I became their deputy chair. But in the end, even though I got a huge amount of environmental policies through the party, I had more success than anybody on a whole range of issues. In the end, I concluded that the current vested interests that are around the political party leaderships of all the parties are, it will take so long to get around them that you have to find another way to do it. And the other way of doing it is a little Gandhian. You be the change you want to be the change, do it yourself, and then actually try and use the media to get that message across and convince people and create a wave that way that the politicians have to follow. What I'm trying to prove is it's possible to have a low-carbon lifestyle and have a reasonably Western lifestyle. I've got a fridge, I've got a washing machine, I've got a shower, I've got heating, I've got a laptop, I've got lighting, but my carbon is a fraction. If everybody in the world had my carbon footprint, we wouldn't be having a problem. So that's really important to me, to be able to demonstrate you can't have a Western lifestyle. Because my feeling is that quite often when I give talks, I pick up a toothbrush and I say this represents my philosophy, and they look at me as like completely mad. And why I say it is I actually believe we at least waste 80% of resources in how we achieve our lifestyles that we need to do. So I pick up the toothbrush and I take the head off it and I show, you throw away the entire toothbrush, I only throw away the head, because it's a disposable head toothbrush. And so, you know, if you think about it, 40 million toothbrushes being thrown away every 3 months in Britain, that's 160 million toothbrushes. Every 8 toothbrushes is probably the equivalent of a kilometre void for a car. So it sounds like a small thing, but it represents everything through thing. People come home in the evening and they turn on the light in the kitchen, they turn on the bathroom, they go up and look at their laptop, and they turn on the light in the bedroom, then they go to the spare bedroom to get a piece of paper, and then they come down to cook their meal. And they've left all the lights on in every single room of the house, and they'll be on till they go to bed. They can't be in more than one room at a time. So instantly you're wasting 6 times the amount of energy you should be wasting on electricity. And then if you have energy saving bulbs, I mean, you know, in my house the entire wattage for my bulbs, okay, it's a 2-up, 2-down, 2-bedroom house, is 180 watts, but there's some of the houses I've eco-audited, they're using 13,000 watts to light their house, you know, for 3 kids and a wife. You know, that just tells you the potential to waste is just quite enormous. The most important thing in what I've done is actually, you know, I really seriously don't have the heating or light on in rooms I'm not in. And that's the most basic thing you can do. And the other thing, but just, you know, making sure you've energy light bulbs, making sure, you know, windows and doors have their holes sealed up. I mean, I haven't got double glazing in every room in this house, you know, that's because it doesn't, because my energy bills are so low here. My gas bill's around £100 a year. So if I save, let's say I save 25% of my gas, by having all my windows double glaze and was saving £25 a year, and the investment would have been around 8 to 10,000. Doesn't make sense. But I still want to have low energy, you know. I still want to have low carbon. So, you know, things like making sure my chimney is blocked. I've got a chimney balloon up my chimney so that the heat isn't escaping through my chimney. So those basic things. I mean, when I went to companies or people, I really say this is just about a good housekeeping.
Mm.
It's having an independent eye coming out from the outside and just looking around your house and thinking where you're wasting electricity. And I find things like people have, you know, they will have the AG on, left on right through the summer and forgotten to turn it off. I've come across central heating systems on where people thought they were off in August. I've come across places where they have the heating on to counteract the air conditioning. But the room's too cold, so they put on the heating.
Mm.
I've come across a charity that switched from hot food to cold food, and they had 4 deep freezers running for the last 2 years empty, nothing in them. It's just good housekeeping.
Mm.
Or people having, you know, they have their central heating on, and the timer, nobody knows how to use a timer, so the timer's on from 6 till 10 and maybe on from 5 till 12. They go to bed at 10. Mm. So it's on for another 2 hours pointlessly. They might get up at 8, so it's been on for 2 hours instead of 1 hour, and they leave the house at 9 and it's on for another hour after they've left the house.
So the type of people that you're auditing, what's their motivation? Is it, I mean, electricity prices are going up, fuel bills going up, so is that part of the motivation, or is there much more of an ecological awareness?
I've come across almost every kind of motivation, and I to be frank with you, I don't care what the motivation is, so long as actually it inspires them to cut their carbon footprint. I get everything from, you know, rich people afraid that they might be cut off in a power cut, with nothing to do with the environment, just total looking after themselves. They're terrified of their own energy security. To people who are absolutely terrified of what's happening to the planet and feel really guilty about it. To grandparents or young women really feeling they don't want the world to be trashed because they realise their grandchildren or their children, they'll be, you know, reaching 40 when it's 2050, and then just think, cripes, you know, that's when the crisis could really, really hit heavily, and we don't want the world to be trashed, and so they want to find out how they can take steps to do it.
Mm.
So I find the whole range of motivations.
So, I mean, I kind of like the approach that you outline in the book. I think makes a lot of good sense about auditing where you are and finding out what your carbon footprint is,
right,
and then making a plan for a year. Things you're going to commit to over the year to bring your emissions down and save some money along the way, and then repeating that every year, which is so you're kind of chipping away at it and going further and making a long term commitment, and that's pretty much what you've done as well.
Yeah, I think what's a wonderful motivation for people is progress.
Mm.
And being able to say, yeah, I have done something, and you kind of pat yourself on the back. Sometimes when I do eco audits I don't do it for households, that's up to themselves to do, but if I do it for a business, I won't accept a contract unless included in the price up front is my return visit, because I feel human motivation reports sit on shelves.
Mm.
And I feel a lot of the work will be done for the month before, when I ring them up and say, when would you want me to come back? Between that day, oh God, Dunica's coming back, we've got to get it sorted. But also, I mean, I do find when I go back, they're kind of quite often say, oh, we're really sorry, we haven't done very much, and we're kind of stuck. And then you go to the list, and they're like, oh, they've done this, and they've done this, and they've done this, and you actually go, oh. And that to me is really important to keep the motivation going. Because I don't want somebody to read my book or for me to come and have an audit and be really inspired for 2 weeks. And then they go on to the next thing.
Mm.
I think it's really important that there's ways of rewarding themselves and motivating themselves, and measurement really works.
Mm.
And, you know, carbon footprint is definitely going to be really become, I think, one of the key areas where people will be able to measure progress and notify it, and that's going to become a key tool.
So how many years have you been on, was it since you come back from the Amazon?
I mean, literally when I
chipping away.
I mean, yeah, I mean, literally when I came back from the Amazon, I was a ballet dancer with very little income.
Mm.
I was a freelance ballet dancer. So I did what I would do is, every week, the first step I took was I would buy one thing at the supermarket that was organic. And so the first time I went shopping, I bought a bottle of organic ketchup. And, you know, I was able to cope that within my limited income. And I went from there.
Mm.
And now around 95% of my food is organic. And yeah, obviously you've seen the progress that I've made in the house and how that's going.
Mm.
from, you know, house, this house had nothing environmentally friendly in it when I arrived, and now it's, you know, it's probably one of the most eco-retrofitted houses in Britain, which is quite nice.
How cost-effective, in terms of cash, have your installations been? Or have they been quite investment-heavy?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you don't... I mean, I've explained all the ways you can save money and you can reduce your energy, but by just lifestyle stuff and small investments in energy efficiency like light bulbs and stuff. I mean, when I talk to people, I always say it's 40% lifestyle, it's 40% small investments in energy efficiency, like, you know, insulation on the roof, or insulation in the doorways and windows, or getting your chimney blame sorted, or making sure you've got an energy efficient fridge. But then the last 15-20% is the renewables, and that's a gold plated part of it. And for every pound you'll spend on basic insulation, you'll be spending £8 to £10 for the equivalent saving in carbon and renewables. Renewables are really first generation, most of them are still first generation technologies, and so they're quite expensive. And most of them don't have an economic payback period yet. Some people argue they do. Solar hot water is maybe, you know, 10 to 15 years, and depends how much you use, depends on whether you're family or not, etc., etc. But you still, most of the renewable technologies, you're doing it because you want to save the planet, not because you want to save money. They are very heavy on investment up front. What I've done in my house, you could probably do now for around 16,000-17,000, which is the price of, you know, I haven't had a car. So it's the price of an upmarket car. But over, you know, over the years, you know, I'm not paying for a car, so I save £3,000 a year. That's, you know, the estimate costs £3,000 to run a car for a year. So I've done everything to my house for the price of not having a car for 6 years, which I think is a reasonably good, much more. I far prefer boasting over a dinner party, you know, I've got, you know, I'm exporting electricity to the grid, and I've got a nice new BMW outside of my forecourt, you know, it's, I think, far more fun and rewarding to be able to boast about. My carbon footprint last year was half a ton. I don't want to go backwards, I want to go forwards and get it down to zero, because the average carbon footprint for a house in Europe is 8.5 tons. You know, I'm an absolute fraction of that, which is great. But I want to keep it going. I'd like to get it down to zero as much as I could. Part of the reason why I'm down to half a ton is some of my gas emissions are made up from the excess of electricity exported. Last year, I exported 20% more electricity to the grid than I imported.
So you deduct back from your...
I deduct back from my carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I could get... I mean, my ambition is to try and get to zero.
Great. That'd be fantastic.
You've been listening to an interview with Donoghue McCarthy on The 2 Degrees Show. And if you want to get hold of Donoghue's book, Saving the Planet Without Costing the Earth, or find out more about his eco-auditing services, check out his website, which is www.3acorns.co.uk. Next week we have an interview with George Monbiot about his new book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. Thanks for listening. If you want to hear the show again, it will be archived shortly at Coinnet, that's coinet.org.uk/climateradio.